listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, a look at Choose Your Own Adventure books and stories. I have some nostalgic memories, and they've made a comeback. Join the conversation about Choose Your Own Adventures as storytelling. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, left-leaning comedy had a solid run as the more popular form of political comedy on television and other platforms. But recent years have seen a rise in more conservative and or libertarian comedy content. The conservative-leaning talk show Gutfeld on Fox News has strong ratings on late-night TV, and The Joe Rogan Experience is one of the most popular podcasts in the U.S. Our next guest says left- and right-leaning comedy have significant influences on the political landscape, and people on either side of the aisle shouldn't ignore the opposite side's comedy, even if they don't find it funny. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch or listen to political comedy? Do you like comedy in your politics? Do you think that comedians have an impact on people's political views, maybe even on how they vote? What kind of stuff do you watch, listen to, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Marks is an associate professor of film and media studies at Colorado State University. He's co-author of the new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. He's also a Wisconsin native and graduate of UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You talk in the book about a big divide, I think even an awareness of conservative comedy, and that's probably true among listeners. I know we just did a segment on late night TV a couple weeks back. We have Greg Gutfeld fans out there, people who listen to or watch the things you talk about in your book. And then there are people who are oblivious, or maybe just seen the name, don't know what it's all about. Can you talk about that divide even in knowing this exists?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the major goals of the book is simply to make our fellow liberals aware that conservatives are doing comedy successfully. They're economically profitable. They get TV ratings, as you just mentioned, in the case of Gutfeld. And this comedy has the potential to recruit new members to conservative causes in much the same way that political satire functioned on the left through figures like Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, and others over the years.
Right.
The interesting thing we found was that a lot of our fellow liberals were simply oblivious or didn't know about this robust world of right-wing comedy that we describe in the book for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, your book is, in effect, a tour of conservative political comedy for a liberal audience, I think, to understand it. I want to go back to a moment where I think a lot of the people you're talking to may have stopped paying attention, where you know, you had The Daily Show and its various spinoffs and imitators, and there were conservative efforts on Fox News and elsewhere to replicate that, to create the conservative Daily Show, and they failed. And some of the people you talk to in the book, and you quote critics and others saying, aha, this means liberals can be funny in this political way and conservatives can't. But then what happened?
That's right. The example of Fox News's 2007 failed Daily Show, the half-hour news hour, is often cited by our fellow liberal media researchers and political communication scholars as evidence that, well, the right tried to make a Daily Show back in 2007, and it failed. And admittedly, it was quite bad if you go back and watch episodes. And it's still held up as evidence today that conservatives can't be funny, that they don't have the psychology, they don't have the taste in order to create comedy. We think that's being willfully blind to the multitude of not only different comedy forms that are out there today, but the platforms that deliver it across our social media feeds, across established TV channels like Fox News and others. So to simply go back 15 years and say, well, yeah, conservatives tried this and it wasn't very good, therefore they're still unable to do it, to me, simply rings false.
And let's talk about Greg Gutfeld now, a central figure in your book. Fox News went from, I think, a 3 a.m. show to a weekend late night show to every weekend night and doing quite well with it in the ratings. Where do you position him in the world of conservative leaning comedy on Fox News?
Yeah, so Gutfeld is very much one of the faces, if not the face, of late night on Fox News today. He gets his start doing a, frankly, experimental comedy show called Red Eye for years in the early to mid 2000s, where it was a pretty conventional sort of news talk show, but he'd often have on stand-up comedians, writers, people who were inclined to have a satiric, ironic take on the news. He moves into a Saturday slot in 2015, the Greg Gutfeld show. This show begins to attract eyeballs, especially with the start of the Trump presidency and the sort of comedic modes of address that Trump brought into his presidential term. Such was Gutfeld's success that by 2021, Fox News moved him to a nightly show directly opposite The Daily Show to compete with that show. And it was routinely beating not only that liberal satire show on Comedy Central, but also the late night broadcast stalwarts of Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, and Jimmy Kimmel.
One key thing here is we have so many options of what to watch that a niche comedy show, if it can connect with the right audience, whether The Daily Show did with a more liberal, younger audience, or Gutfeld can at the end of the day on Fox News with a built-in conservative audience. That's something we might not have been able to do when you had three choices late at night. You had to have a big tent and bring in as many viewers as possible.
It's a great point. And part of the sort of story we tell in the book is one of a move from a broadcast era with three channels into a sort of, you know, divided up cable era towards the end of the 90s into the 2000s to today, where media platforms more or less serve us in hyper individualistic taste circles, right? And it is content producers like Fox News, like Joe Rogan, the platforms like Spotify, it's their mission to kind of find these very, very small accumulations of audiences and aggregate them in political affiliation, demographic similarities, so that the measure of success, maybe getting 500,000 people to watch your show, is radically smaller today than it was even 5-10 years ago. This is the sort of media industry environment that's allowed something as seemingly unthinkable as conservative comedy to not only rise up, but to flourish wholly unnoticed by so many folks on the left.
Talking to Nick Marks, co-author of the book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Seth is with us in Sparta. Seth, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Seth?
Hey, you know, so in regards to, you know, the left and the right and what's funny, what's not, and who can have a sense of humor and who can't have a sense of humor, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human and we're all Americans. And, you know, you got to look at, you know, both sides of the aisle, because, you know, you might be a conservative and you might find some liberal dudes who are super funny. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, we're all not going to get out of this alive, so you might as well do it while you can.
Seth, thanks for the call. Now, Nick, I know you're hoping that people at least be aware of the political comedy happening on the other side of the aisle. Can you talk about the value of that?
Yeah, part of it is absolutely an acknowledgement of our shared humanity. So it is a basic human impulse to laugh. And importantly, laughter has really powerful affiliative bonds. It brings us closer together with other human beings. We so rarely are in the same room with other people that we don't know laughing at the same thing, right? You think of what you used to do going to the movies to see a Jim Carrey or a Will Ferrell movie back in the day. You didn't know most of the people in that dark movie theater. Today, comedy is not as much of a sort of bonding mechanism across difference. Today, comedy is much more likely to bond you with somebody who's already inclined to think like you, to laugh at the same thing as you, and you're unlikely to encounter someone who's politically, you know, divergent from you and share in that bonding power of laughter like we once were 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Seth, thanks for that call. Now, Nick, I don't want to ignore what ends up being the dark side of the book here. You know, one end of a conservative comedy political spectrum might be somebody making fun of a Democratic president, Democratic politicians. Not too out of the ordinary, really. But there's an ecosystem here that goes from there to some, as you tapped into, some really dark places. Can you connect the dots for us a little?
That's right. So the other sort of major argument we make in the book is that the sort of mainstream faces many folks might be familiar with, Greg Gutfeld, Joe Rogan, are connected and intentionally connect with more sort of malevolent voices further and further right on the political spectrum. So while listening to an episode of the Joe Rogan Experience itself might not be a sort of political act or a right-wing act. Joe Rogan frequently has on libertarian comedians like the stand-up comedian Dave Smith, who then goes on somebody else's podcast or a talk show, who's got some ideas about race science or about what we should do with folks at the border. These connections are made clear for listeners and users via social media algorithms, right? So the more that you click on, like, comment on, engage with one of these comedians, the likelier Facebook, Twitter, and others are to connect you to folks further and further down into the sort of dark layer of trolls. And frankly, folks like Gavin McInnes, the Proud Boys founder, is a prominent figure we talk about in the book. So it's not that the immediate act of watching Gutfeld, listening to Rogan, is itself a bad thing, but it can lead to much more bad faith and evil actors the more you engage with this world.
We're talking to media studies professor Nick Marks about his new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like political comedy that you agree with? Do you avoid political comedy that you don't agree with? Do you have a favorite figure, past or present, who treats politics broadly defined in a humorous way? Do you have a question for our guest about his book and his work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nick Marks, media studies professor at Colorado State University, co-author of the new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. He's with us today to talk about the role comedy plays in politics, how the landscape has shifted in recent years, offering a tour of conservative comedy, especially for the unfamiliar. You could join in whether you're familiar with it or not. 800-642-1234. Where do you go for political humor? Or do you just not find politics funny? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Beth is with us in Beaver Dam. Beth, hi.
Hi. For 25 years, I've enjoyed watching The View. So back in the day, I would record it on a VCR, and today I watch it on my phone. My favorite commentator is Joy Behar, who is a comedian, and Whoopi Goldberg, the moderator, is also a comedian. And they always have one conservative host, and they don't seem to last. It's kind of like a revolving door. And then if you read the comments or critics, the attitude for them is towards them is murderous, so critical in whatever that they say.
Interesting. Beth, thanks for the call. Nick, outside of your book a little bit, but your thoughts on The View and political comedy.
No, I think it's a great example that both Joy and Whoopi are stand-up comedians. That's where they made their name. And that show, when it's at its best, is funny, or it's having sort of satiric takes on the news of the day. I will say that the Meghan McCain chair that she filled for years is intentional, right? I don't know that that show is as sort of balanced as it makes itself out to be, but it makes for great television to have her sort of be the sort of face of disagreement to the majority sort of liberal panelists on that show.
Thanks for that call. Jim joins us now in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hello. I think The View, and funny you brought that up, I think The View supplies more comedy just by their hypocrisy. I mean, the show has a certain sense of comedy, and they do target conservatives. But most of the comedy comes afterwards when you hear the hypocrisy of what they say. And just with a little bit of analysis, it really makes the left look bad. And I do listen to public radio, and I listen to some conservative talk shows. And I got to say, the comedy is really on the conservative side. There's just so much material out there. And I do not know why any of the late night shows are, they don't make any attempts at Biden. They don't make any attempts at, just the hypocrisy that goes on with their policies. That's what I see.
Jim, thanks for the call. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, it is. It's a valid point generally that many of our television liberal comedians have gone soft in recent years. The function of folks like Colbert, the folks on The View, and others has been less and less to make us laugh, especially in the Trump era, and more to be a sort of soothing presence to say, they're there, the orange man is bad, he'll be gone soon, and we'll get back to life as normal. Well, now that he's gone, those shows haven't necessarily gone back to being as funny and sort of transgressive as they were in a previous era. That's got a whole host of factors behind it, but the main one is, I think, those shows just aren't in the business of making us laugh anymore. They're too sort of broadly general entertainment based. And I think there's something to that caller's point that this mantle of edgy, sort of experimental, sometimes comedy is very much being taken up by folks on the right, where folks on the left have been vacating that space.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steven joins us now in Milwaukee. Steven, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
What did you want to bring up, Steven?
I want to bring the fact that, you know, I'm a liberal, and I'm also a comedian. I've been a comedian in the comedy in the past, and I feel like it's a catch-22 where it's like, yeah, okay, you know, you can, you know, Joe Rogan and all this kind of stuff, yeah, which I do annoys me and stuff like that, but it's also like, Jon Stewart also insulted people too. They insult people and they have on people and they're both spectrums. It's like, we're all human beings. Comedy should just be comedy. And I think that when you, and I do think the left side gets too butt hurt about like their comedy, because it's like, oh my God, he said this and they said that, and they get so offended so quickly when comedy is comedy. And I do agree with what the talker was saying about, like, yes, to lead things on the path. But, I mean, we are adults here, right? I mean, you can choose to think, like, I watch everything and I, you know, laugh at everything.
I gotcha, Steven. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, there is, yes, comedy is comedy. But part of our analysis in the book is pointing out how there's very little money to be made by comedians from just sort of trying to please all sides, from trying to do this very broad general audience-based joking. Instead, the thing that algorithms push to the top of our feed, the thing that advertisers want to pay for, is stuff further and further in either direction. Extremity, right? Polarity is what sort of drives not only our political discourse, but what drives profitable cultural products like podcasts and late night talk shows too.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into one particular part of your book, Nick, in the darker part of a conservative humor, I guess, conservative comedy. Some of the trolling that goes on, with literally to the extreme of people making jokes about the Holocaust. And then when people respond, well, that's the joke. I managed to make you respond to this horrific thing I said. Can you talk about that trolling edge here?
Yeah, strangely enough, this is the form of right-wing humor that many liberals are perhaps familiar with, because it's such a familiar part of sort of online discourse and online culture. What you see on the right in figures like Gavin McInnes and Nick Fuentes and some of the well, out-and-out Nazi podcasts that we researched for the book is, again, an economic incentive to go where other comedians would not go. So folks see that, you know, Tim Allen is occupying this sitcom dad version of conservative comedy, and Joe Rogan is the libertarian sort of mouthpiece of the right wing. Well, some of the other further right trolling voices we identify say, hey, what if we went a step beyond all of those folks? All we have to do is garner an audience that's a fraction of theirs, and we can stay profitable and hope to take the next step up the next rung of the ladder to try to get more and more exposure.
And finally, Nick, one thing that kind of bugs me about a lot of political comedy, left or right, is that, okay, I have a show, I know my audience agrees with my perspective, whether it's a left or right show. I make a joke that makes fun of the other side and they're going to laugh at it. It's like a 90s comic being at a convention of people who hate airline food. Like you've got this built-in audience. You say comfortable things. We all agree. Does it really make a difference when that happens?
Yeah. Tina Fey and Seth Meyers famously call this comedy clapter. I think it's pretty prominent in things like the current iteration of The Daily Show, or a host simply says, oh, Mitch McConnell, he's bad. And there's not really a joke. It's just sort of a cheap Mitch McConnell impersonation. So the short answer is no. I don't believe that that version of comedy is making a political impact. What I think is happening in the case of right-wing comedy, at least, is it's drawing in especially younger men who may be politically undecided or ambivalent, and it gets them thinking in the political realm, then introduces them to more and more avowedly political ideas of the libertarian ilk or whatever. So that initial encounter might not be a political act, but it gets politically ambivalent, especially younger folks, thinking further and further down the line. And we're saying that right now comedy is serving this function in a right-wing manner.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Nick Marks, Associate Professor of Film and Media Studies at Colorado State University. He's co-author of the book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. With us today looking at shifts in political comedy over the years and how that can influence the political landscape as a whole. Still interested in data from you, or a datum from you, as we heard on the Grammar Show this week? Let us know. Do you seek out political comedy? Who do you watch? Who do you avoid? Or do you avoid it as a genre? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, control of Congress is at stake in November with big issues like abortion, election law, and a whole lot more at stake. We'll look at the state of the race to control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate and what could swing things one way or another, whether it's issues, the economy, and more. And fall is a great time for some homemade comfort food. On this week's edition of Food Friday, a Wisconsin cook brings us some home cooking comfort with great ingredients and recipes for the time and place. You can let us know your favorite comfort food to make at home. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a new report says Wisconsin hasn't taken good care of its environment over the last decade, especially when it comes to water quality. And they say that puts public health at risk. We'll talk to the author, and you could join the conversation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the midterm elections could bring about changes to voting laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere. We'll talk to an election law expert about what's been proposed and what it could all mean for how we cast our ballots. First, a report released by the group Wisconsin Green Fire Voices for Conservation says that Wisconsin isn't doing enough to protect its environment and natural resources. The report, called Imbalance of Power, looks at changes in state law and rulemaking authority and how they changed Wisconsin's environmental protection policies. In particular, the report looks at water in the state, including drinking water, nitrate contamination, and shoreline degradation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin's doing enough to protect water quality? Have you seen changes over the years or the decades, if you've been watching for a while, in the way environmental protection works in the state? Are these important issues, your local water quality, when you go to cast a ballot? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Fred Clark is Executive Director of Wisconsin's Green Fire Voices for Conservation, co-author of the report Imbalance of Power, How Wisconsin is Failing Citizens in Conserving Natural Resources and Protecting Our Environment. Fred, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be with you all today.
I want to start off in the past a little bit. You write in the report that Wisconsin at one point had a reputation for strong environmental protections, kind of watched around the country, and bipartisan support for those protections. Can you take us back to that time?
Well, it's true. I think for at least most of the second half of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century, Wisconsin has been viewed as a conservation and environmental leader. And one really good example of that leadership was covered by WPR and news stories in the last 2 days around the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. And that was an example of where just profound impacts of pollution from primarily industrial processes had made many of our water bodies in the state unusable and unsafe. And it was an example of where state government the business community and the environmental community came together to develop solutions that not only address those profound problems, but in the end were actually good for business and good for the quality of life in Wisconsin communities. That's an example of our ability to solve big problems, and our concern is that we've lost that ability today.
Now, as we talk on the show and you talk in your report about things like PFAS in water, nitrates in water, problems with shoreline protections, these are in the news now. And you point in this report toward a turning point in the way Wisconsin laws and regulation rules happen. And this can get down in the weeds, but can you look at some of the key changes and how they affect our water protections?
Sure. And what we wanted to do in this report was to tie together some of the foundational reasons that we've seen, honestly, failure after failure in addressing some of these important issues like PFAS and like nitrates. And so what we point to in the report are changes in law that occurred in 2011 and 2017, primarily, that changed the way state government agencies are able to develop what are called administrative rules. And administrative rules are simply the set of rules that codify the work of executive branch agencies. They're really, you can think of them as the DNA of our state government. We have rules that cover everything from highway construction to food safety to what children learn in schools. And we have rules around natural resources and the environment. That's what allows state agencies the authority to do their job and implement programs. And we've made the rule development process almost completely non-functional and unworkable today. And the result is we're unable to deal with these emerging problems that badly need solutions.
Can you talk about how those changes, especially as they apply to the DNR, affect, say, an emerging water quality problem like, say, PFAS?
Well, sure. So, the rule process really requires state agencies to work together with stakeholders, with regulated entities, and with affected parties to develop new guidance around these emerging issues. And in the case of PFAS, unfortunately, the Department of Natural Resources, after a significant amount of work, after almost 3 years of effort, brought forward three different rule revisions to the Natural Resources Board earlier this summer. One of the most important one of those was setting standards for PFAS in groundwater, which affects somewhere over a huge number, almost a quarter of Wisconsin citizens who get their drinking water from private wells would have seen for the first time a standard around PFAS in their water that would allow state government to take action and help protect those people. And unfortunately, our Natural Resources Board voted down that rule package. And the way the laws that govern rule development work now, that starts the clock over again, such that it will take an additional almost 3 years of effort before the state can even come forward with a new rule package. And that's just simply unacceptable. Unfortunately, we're making state government impossible to manage as a result of these changes that, from our point of view, are both bad for business and they're bad for Wisconsin citizens.
Another key step involved a lot of these rules is going to a key legislative committee on rules. How has that impacted efforts to protect water quality?
Right. So what we highlight in our report are the number of changes that have been made in that 10-year period beginning in 2011 that have added additional hurdles to the rule development process. And we don't argue that there's an important role for the legislature to approve and provide a check and a balance with the executive branch in rule development. But at this point, the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules, which is a legislative body that most members of the public have never heard of, has a tremendous amount of authority to completely block, indefinitely block the implementation of a rule, or to send a rule back to an agency for revision. But what we're not seeing there is a transparent process that brings the public and public input and public interest into those decisions. What it also does is bring the requirement for an economic analysis that is structured in a way that almost makes it guaranteed that some rules will not be able to pass if the cost of implementing that rule is deemed to exceed a $10 million threshold. And what's not addressed at all in that requirement is any analysis of the benefits of having a rule that might protect water quality, the health benefits, the environmental benefits, the economic benefits to property owners, for example, who are absorbing substantial costs right now because of contaminated water. So there's a real imbalance in the structure and how rules are evaluated and developed, and we make recommendations for how to restore that balance.
Talking to Fred Clark from the group Wisconsin's Green Fire, looking at a new report on changes in environmental rulemaking laws in the state that the group says have had an impact on our water quality in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your local experience with water at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you see as the health impact of these changes, Fred? In the report, you highlight some people, especially in rural communities who rely on well water, who are affected by these changes.
Sure. Well, we profiled a couple of examples of citizens who are being affected by our inability as a state to address these problems. And so, you know, with the example of PFAS contamination, and as many of your viewers know, PFAS are these persistent, long-lived environmental chemicals that come from a variety of sources. The state of Wisconsin has now detected PFAS contamination in over 90 different locations in Wisconsin. And some of the most profoundly affected areas are around places where firefighting foam has been used or tested. So in the town of Peshtigo, for example, there's a very high density of groundwater contamination as a result of PFAS manufacturing and testing. And we, as a result of the Natural Resources Board failure to adopt a rule, we still do not have a standard for groundwater. But anecdotally, many of these communities are too small to support a robust epidemiological study that would make a positive determination about health impacts. But if you talk to physicians who are treating individual patients, the rate of cancers, thyroid problems, and other health impacts that are known to be associated with these type of contaminants are much higher than practitioners normally see. So there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that health effects are already being experienced, and we simply are failing to address that crisis.
Talking to Fred Clark, executive director of the group Wisconsin's Green Fire, about a new report showing the impact of changing state policies on environmental issues within the state, especially when it comes to water. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about water quality here in the state? Do you think it's too difficult to get new rules and regulations passed, or do you think we are in the right place now when it comes to how we protect water quality without bureaucratic overreach, as supporters of some of these changes argued? Do you have a concern in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Fred Clark, executive director of Wisconsin's Green Fire, about a report released by the group that looks at changes in environmental laws and rules in the state and how they affect water quality issues. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your local story at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Phyllis is with us in the town of Dunn. Phyllis, hi.
Hi. I just want two things. I want to emphasize that the Republicans are the ones who are stopping all these rules that would protect people from poisons like PFAS through their majority in the state legislature. And at the top of the Republican ticket in Wisconsin is Tim Michaels, and he's running for governor against Tony Evers. And he co-owns a company, Michaels Corp., that has been very dangerous to our water, very damaging. And now he's poised to endanger the whole Great Lakes, because his company has a letter of intent from Enbridge, the Canadian oil pipeline company, to build the proposed expansion of their Line 5. And it would go through the very water-rich area in Ashland and Iron Counties, and would, if when it ruptures there, and they always do rupture sooner or later, it could pollute the Kakagan Sloughs, it could ruin the Copper Falls State Park, and go actually into Lake Superior, and who knows how far it would spread there. Perhaps
Phyllis, I gotcha. Thanks for calling in. Fred, I don't know if you want to make partisan suggestions here, but your thoughts on what Phyllis had to say.
Well, several comments here from Phyllis. I'll make one point, though. Politics is ultimately local. And what we have seen in a good way is that when some of these critical issues come home to local legislative districts, whether you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, you are forced to pay attention when the citizens in your town are being affected. And so we just, you know, one of our recommendations in this report is to encourage everyone to reach out to their local elected officials or candidates for office, hold them to account around the importance of addressing these issues, and don't accept party affiliation as a yes or no. We need legislators of both parties to be part of a solution.
Phyllis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to callers, Fred, one of the arguments at the Times for these changes was that a sense that maybe the DNR and other state agencies had been given too much authority. They were going beyond the intent of legislation, slowing down business development in some communities. What do you make of that argument?
Well, that's always the tension, and it can be a healthy tension between the role of government and the role of the private sector and, you know, individual freedoms. Our point of view on this is that if we look back to a period when government was actually effective, it was effective because most of the important issues that were dealt with through regulation or other government programs came from a negotiated process that involved industry, it involved businesses, it involved stakeholders and the regulated community. We've simply lost the willingness for parties to come to the table and envision solutions to these problems. But we don't buy the argument that unelected bureaucrats in government shouldn't be given the responsibility of addressing some of these issues. What we're talking about here are career professionals who have deep expertise in water quality and environmental issues of all sorts who are, you know, dedicating their careers to public service. We need to rely on them for their expertise the same way we rely on a doctor to, you know, operate on your gallbladder or a experienced pilot to fly your plane. So we want to reopen that dialogue between government and the business community that unfortunately has been closed off.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hey, the last call, I kind of stole my thunder on the danger of having combined Republican control over the state government. But I guess my other comment was normally the legislature pass laws that are fairly general in nature, I suppose, depending on the subject. And then it's normally tasked the executive branch with doing new rules and regulations. Would there be some kind of a crossover on a constitutional aspect of it where the legislature is actually taking constitutional authority over the executive? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Fred?
Well, I think the caller raises an important question. And for example, with regard to, the appointment of members to public bodies by the executive, by the governor, and the legislature's failure to confirm or even hear those appointments, we believe there is a real constitutional issue there. So that is something to watch. But another point I would make that the caller raised is that is the normal process, is that laws passed by the legislature provide general guidance and direction and authority, and state agencies or federal agencies are expected to develop rules and programs informed by those laws, but that need to have a higher level of detail. And what often happens today, because we have a broken rule process, is that instead of the details that are needed to implement a program being developed in rules, they're often developed in statutes that are passed by the legislature. And the problem with that is that most legislators simply don't have the knowledge to write those laws themselves. So who writes them? Lobbyists. And so that process is actually far less democratic and transparent the way it's working today than it could be if we had a working rules process.
Thanks for the call. Talking to Fred Clark from the group Green Fire about environmental laws, regulations, and rules in Wisconsin. Back to your calls with Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Fred. So I've heard that the foams that contain the PFAS, the reason why they added that ingredient was to increase the efficacy of the firefighting foam. But I haven't been able to find anywhere that gives me a percentage of improvement. And I often wonder the rarity of these fires that we may have. I just drove past Dane County Airport. The rarity of these fires, was this worth all of the contamination that's now occurred to our drinking well water for this, what might be a slight improvement in the efficiency?
Mike, thanks for the call. Fred, costs and benefits of PFAS, especially in the firefighting foam.
Well, really important question. And I'll just note that when the AFF firefighting foam was first developed, it was seen as almost a miracle product. And, you know, there are fire scenarios, especially electrical fires or petroleum-based fires, for which some kind of foam is almost essential for effective suppression. And so before the risk of PFAS in the environment was understood, there was widespread application and testing of these firefighting foam products. And more foam is used in testing than and training than it actually was used in real applications. That's beginning to change now, but we have a legacy, unfortunately, of a long period of widespread use that for which these chemicals have found their way into the environment. And there is no easy remediation.
Thanks for that call, Mike. Fred, before we run out of time, I want to get into one more aspect of your report. This one about a change in the laws, I think, not the rules. When it comes to local government's ability to add environmental restrictions, regulations on water beyond what the state already has. Can you talk about how that works and the impact it has?
Sure. We address the issue of local control and local autonomy in this paper. That used to be our standard. And so we profiled the example of shoreline zoning. It's what property owners along rivers or lakes are able to do and required to do to sort of protect the environment along that critical lakeshore fringe. And it used to be the case that the state laws and state rules set minimum standards with the expectation that local units of government, counties or cities or villages had the ability to set standards that would be higher. We have flipped 180 degrees around that issue in that today, what were originally minimal state standards are now established as maximum standards, and communities are not allowed to exceed them in any requirement, regardless of whatever unique circumstances might occur. So this has been a gift to people who want to see unregulated development, but it has really hurt the ability of local governments and local communities to sort of design their own future. And we point out examples of similar changes around CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, and around frac sand mines and other land uses that tend to be some of the more controversial ones local communities see. That is really moving us backwards in our assessment.
Briefly, Fred, just in our last half a minute, what are you hoping people do with this new report?
So we make a number of recommendations in the report. The most important thing for people to do is to be involved, to follow these issues at the level of the legislature and the Natural Resources Board, to become involved in organizations that represent their interests so that your voice can be magnified, whether you're a business owner or an outdoors person. There are organizations that will help represent your interests that you should support. We also make a number of specific legislative recommendations that we believe would help restore the balance between the ability for state executive branch agencies to function and for the legislature to still maintain a check and a balance, but subject to a transparent process that invites public input.
Fred, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Fred Clark, Executive Director of Wisconsin's Green Fire, talking about a new report from the organization, Imbalance of Power on Water Quality Rules and Regulations in the State. Coming up, voting laws are a big campaign issue in this year's midterms. We'll look at what the elections could mean for the future of how we vote. This is Central Time.